Chat. So last time, so a question, would it be possible to post slides before lectures? I thought I did that. So why aren't they on the schedule? That is interesting and a mistake. So let's resolve that. So, last time we covered race conditions. So, we had inconsistent results with multiple threads. We saw that, you know, it would matter what order things happened to be scheduled in. We mentioned in trying to figure out what would happen in general and try to make sense of this that things that we wanted to be atomic, meaning not interrupted by other things, so we could try to reason about what would happen, were not the same as instructions. So, what does this mean? Well, you know, that meant that if we thought only simple things were atomic, like loading and storing a value, then constructing locks was actually very difficult. We saw, like, a lot of effort to try to do that, and it didn't work out. So what you'd say instead is that we're going to rely on someone to build an abstraction that's going to make us not have to reason about these atomic loads and stores and their consequences, and we're going to have this lock idea where you can acquire it and release it, and when you acquire it, that waits for no one else to be using it, and when you release it, that lets someone else use it. And the intended usage is that you would agree to always acquire this lock abstraction before accessing a shared thing and release it afterwards. We started talking about implementing these locks by disabling interrupts. Okay, so some questions. So one question is that I don't have the slides posted, so I think they're on the web server, but the website wasn't generated. So let's fix that. And another question is, question three on the quiz looks like it's miskeyed, and I agree. I think I wrote a key for an older version of the question is what happened. Is probably what happened. Because that's two. Yeah, I think I wrote a key for an older version of the question. And neglected to update it. Another question, the life assignment, and if you read ahead, the pool assignment mentioned COA2, that is the pilot program's computer organization and architecture course. If you don't know what it is, it doesn't apply to you, but those students had some coverage of threading that is kind of redundant with what we're doing. And because they've done those things before, we want to make that assignment work out better. Why isn't the website updating? Okay. Be surprised to learn the reason why the slides weren't on the website is because I forgot to git push. Okay, other questions before we talk about our topic? topics for today. Okay. So, let's move on to where we started last time, which was about disabling interrupts for locking. And sorry about being a little befuddled with looking at quizzes and slides. So, we originally talked about implementing locks on a single core when we finished last time, and for that, we only need to worry about context switches. If there's a single core, we don't need to worry about two cores trying to actually modify something at the same time, and we can disable context switches by disabling interrupts. So interrupts are external events, like timers expiring and so on, that cause the OS to run, even though the program's not trying to do so. Those are the only things that are going to cause something to happen while a lock is acquired. So we'll end up with some lock code like this. And notably, you know, here, you know, acquiring one lock, you know, acquires all of them. And this is not going to be true in our general case. But when we have a single core, the notion is, well, it's probably okay if we only allow one lock to be used at a time, because, you know, there's only one thing that we can actually run at a time on like a multi-core system. Now, this is not something we actually want to expose to normal applications, and there's a bunch of reasons why. So one big reason is that disabling interrupts hangs the system, that if I have a bug in my application, and this is the locking API you provide me, I can hang the system if I have an infinite loop that nothing else will ever get to run. There's some other issues, which is like if I want to do I/O. So we normally expect to, you know, be able to like get a lock and read something, for example, from the disk. And this will also hang the system because this read is waiting for the disk to give an interrupt and we've disabled them. And probably more notably, we'd like to run other programs while reading. So this is not so good for, you know, programs where we're doing something other than a little computation in the lock. The other issue is that we can't do nested locks, that sometimes we'll have multiple locks and we want them to work sensibly, that they're kind of independent, that acquiring the second lock, you know, will make sure that if someone else locked the store lock, you know, that they won't run at the same time as this, but they can still run at the same time as we're checking for milk here. So that's a common pattern. And this code here has this problem that, well, this unlock unlocks every lock rather than just this store lock, because we haven't actually put code in here which figures out which lock we're locking or unlocking. Now, these first two problems here are indeed a problem for a locks which would be used by normal applications, but if we're thinking about making locks for the OS, disabling interrupts is actually a common strategy within the kernel code. There, we can make sure that the author of that code knows what they're doing and doesn't write code that does these things with if they're using that type of lock. We do care about this issue when we're writing kernel code, and XV6's spin locks, in fact, use this disabling strategy, but they have a fix to deal with this nested locking issue. So if you look at the XV6 spin locks, there's an acquire and release function, and the first thing the acquire function does is disable interrupts with this push CLI function, and the last thing the release function does is re-enable interrupts. And the rest of the code, which I'm not showing on the slide, is just to handle multi-core. But this push CLI and pop CLI don't always disable and re-enable interrupts. They're designed to be in pairs. And the idea is that they keep track of a counter, and push CLI disables interrupts if they're not already disabled. But if they are, it just increments a counter. And put pop CLI re-enables interrupts if they were previously disabled by the matching push CLI. So these are common pairs, and this means that this nested lock here should work correctly. So questions about this idea here? Okay, so that's our basic locks. Now, we want to actually implement the rest of locks. So to actually implement complete locks, we're going to need this other part that works for multicore. And it might seem like, okay, well, we can build that off of this prior idea we had for implementing locks with sort of atomic load and store. But actually, it's a bit trickier than that. And one way to think about this is that I told you that reading and writing words was atomic. And it's atomic in the sense that, like, it happens all at once or not at all. But it's not atomic in some other ways. So in some ways, it's atomic, but it's not what you might think atomic means in some other ways. So here, I have code where thread A writes 1 to a global variable X and returns the value of Y. And thread B does the opposite. It writes 1 to Y and returns the value of X. And I run these at the same time and print out the two return values. And we'd expect that the possible results are these. That either we execute this move, then this move, then the returns in some order, which would be this first outcome, or thread A executes these two things and then thread B executes these, or we have thread B executes and then thread A. So these are our possible outcomes, it looks like. So questions about how I got those possible outcomes? Okay, so we have these outcomes, and you might say, so what's the actual result? Well, I ran this 100 million times on my desktop, and I counted how many times I got each of these results. And I got this result. Not very often, but I got it. That's both of these return zero. And there's no way you can order the operations without, like, switching the order of the move into X and the read of Y, or vice versa for B, to get these double zero results. So it seems like these loads aren't, like, happening in the right order, and that's in fact what's happening. The processor doesn't actually run these instructions in the order they're written, and that seems really problematic. So one reason this seems really problematic is that, well, it seems like this would make it hard to implement locks. Another reason it seems really problematic is that this kind of suggests, well, like, even if we're using locks, how do we know locks do the right thing? Like, how do we know that they keep us from having, you know, if we, like, put a lock here, is that going to solve the problem? We need an answer to that question. And this probability is, of course, this is, like, really infrequent. And that's actually kind of a problem, because if we think about how this would manifest as a bug, well, if we'd have, like, some server where that ran for a year, and once a year this would happen. So the issue here is that these loads and stores are atomic. That is, they happen all at once. They aren't interrupted, but they run out of order. And you may have, in a prior class, learned about this idea of out-of-order processors, and this is related to that the processors will as an optimization, sometimes execute instructions in a non-program order. And on a single core, as part of doing this, they carefully make sure that when they're doing that, no program sees that the instructions are executing out of order. So they do that within a thread. But between cores, they don't go to the effort of making it seem like the instructions are actually executing in the same order. So if you don't want the processor to do this, you need special instructions to ensure that the ordering is stricter in the places where you care. And what we're going to do is that we're going to, we'll include these as part of locks. And that will make it so we can reason about what our locks mean, that our locks are also going to have the special instruction to say, hey, processor, make sure that all the loads and stores before I acquire this lock, you know, finish, and all the loads and stores before I release this lock finished, so I don't get confused about, you know, this ordering issue. So our question is, what do I mean here by tracking side effects? So let's say I have a write to some variable X and a read from a pointer. On a single core, the processor will make sure that if this pointer happens to point to X, that this read here will always happen after this write. So it realizes that this has a side effect of changing what this is going to do. Does that make sense? And this is within the current. So the question is this within the current thread or is this special? So this is like, if this were our assembly code, the processor is going to execute this correctly, even if it would want to, like, run this store later. So it will, on within a thread, it will avoid reordering in ways which change your answer. But if these two statements were in different threads, there's no guarantee like that unless we use special instructions or... Well, it turns out there are some guarantees, but they're looser than you would expect. So the question is, wouldn't you want this anywhere, everywhere, and not just in locks? So the way that we're going to deal with this in practice for the most part is that whenever threads cooperate, we are going to use something like locks in order to make sure that they behave correctly. And by using something like locks or barriers or some other synchronization construct, we won't have to worry about this as a normal programmer, because if we're using the locks or the barriers correctly, we won't have this problem. Okay. Other questions? Okay. And so this is reordering is something the processor does, you know, because it basically avoids delaying the load. Is that probably what happened? Is that processor said, oh, I need to write into X, and that's taking a while. I don't want to wait until that finishes to read Y. So the processor just says, I'm going to read Y now, even though I haven't finished writing X. And that's sort of the performance benefit of it. And the reason why the processor thinks it can do it in this case is that it looks like X and Y are unrelated, because it's only looking at a single thread at a time, because that other thread's on a different core, it's very far away, it's not checking that. And as far as that single thread is concerned, these are unrelated values. Now, I started to do that this is something the processor does. We're also concerned about compilers doing this. So for example, here I have code which sets note from Alice to 1, does a loop while note from Bob is true, and then does, you know, a melt check. So this is kind of implementing that P Peterson's algorithm we showed you earlier. And this code, when I compile it, doesn't actually work. And what happens is the compiler says, okay, you want me to check this note from Bob variable. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to load it into a register, and then I'm going to check that register. And, well, I loaded it once. I don't need to load it again. So it's just checking a value in a register in a loop that will never change because there's nothing in the loop that reloads the thing from the global variable. And the compiler is allowed to do this. The rules of C and C++ say, hey, you don't have to worry about what's going on in other threads. And there's a good reason for this. It's just that, you know, most of the time we want the compiler to do optimizations like loading a variable into a register. We don't want it to have to worry all the time this might be used from another thread. So another way this shows up is that we have this optimization. So here I just say, okay, I'm going to set note from Alice to 1 to give a signal to another thread, then set it to do. And the compiler says, well, you know, I'm going to optimize this not assuming I have to worry about other threads all the time. So it decides, well, we only really need to write the 2 because the write of the 1 doesn't matter in a single-threaded environment. So this stuff that the compiler does, these assumptions it's making, assuming things are single-threaded, well, we can stop it from doing that by giving it some instructions to tell it, hey, something else is going on here. And this is something that something like a lock should have as part of its code. And this is, in fact, something that the pthreads functions do. So the pthread lock and thread create and thread join and barrier and pretty much anything you use to coordinate multiple threads have these extra instructions and extra directives for the compiler to make sure that both of these types of reordering don't happen. That the compiler knows, yes, you have to worry about threads interfering with these values here. Don't reorder thing, you know, make sure that that reordering doesn't happen. Make sure that you write things, even if you think that this thread can't use that value, and so on. So for the part of making the compiler not do this, you need some compiler-specific things. I'm not going to go into what those are. You can see some examples of them in the spinlock implementation of XV6. Now, the processor part, we need some special instruction. One example of such an instruction to give you an idea, like what do we add to our assembly, or what does the compiler add to our assembly when we're worried about the reordering the processor does. So one example is that x86 has an instruction called mFence, which stands for memory fence. And what this instruction does is it makes sure all the load stores that were in progress already that came before the instruction finish, and that none of the loads and stores after the instruction start early. So this is an instruction we can use, for example, in a lock function to make sure that the processor doesn't do something that makes our lock not really work. So the question, when I say that the pthreads functions prevent some optimizations, is this done only around the lock or so on, or is this done globally? So this is generally done only around the lock. So what would happen here, for example, is if we had a pthread, mutex lock call here, that would tell the compiler would realize, say here in an unlock, the compiler would realize, wait a moment, this unlock, would be, the compiler would say, compiler, oh, other threads might need values now. So the unlock and or lock operation will force the compiler to realize, oh, other threads are either going to need values or give me values. And that's the information that the pthreads is going to give the compiler, and that's what's going to prevent optimizations. Does that answer that question? So I mentioned this instruction that we have to use. So the reason why we don't do this all the time, you know, you might, because a reasonable thing is you might say, well, you know, this processor reordering is super non-intuitive. Why can't the compiler just turn that off for me? Well, the instruction to do this is often pretty expensive. So on Skylake, it's like takes 33 cycles to execute. It's not actually something you want to do all the time. Okay. So we talked about reordering, and one thing we haven't talked about is, well, if processors have a shared memory, how does that actually work? And sort of a simple model of how processors communicate is that they can have a shared bus, that the processors and the memory are attached to one common communications mechanism. Everyone sends a message on this, and they like tag their messages. So if CPU 1 wants to get something from memory 1, it's going to say, write a message, memory 1, tell CPU 1, you know, this. And this is going to be some, you know, bunch of wires, and there's going to be some hardware that enforces that only one thing goes at a time and make sure that the cake churns and that we have some way of deciding who goes when. The design of that is not the subject of this class. That's, you know, a different topic. So this is a design that's commonly used in sort of low core count systems. If you have more cores, you want some other design. We're going to kind of ignore that for this class, just so we can talk about it. Now, looking at this model, you might say, okay, so when CPU 1 wants to read something from memory, it goes on this bus to memory, and same thing with CPU 2, and that's how we can make sure that if I write a global variable on one core, I can read it on another. But if you remember your prior computer architecture class, or hopefully whatever comp has as a prereq, you may have heard caches be mentioned. So we want to have local copies of values, and we want those local copies to be on each core, pretty much. Because if they're further out, they're going to be slower. And this leads to a question of, like, how do we deal with each CPU caching the same values? So, like, each CPU is going to have a cache here, and a question is, like, if CPU 1 edits a value in its cache, when do the values change that are outside of its cache? This suddenly really matters. And you may remember from a prior class, or maybe not, but if you think about this bus, you know, we probably don't want to actually send every write on this shared bus here, because that means that it's going to limit how much we can write to memory, even if it's only really matters in our cache. So we'd really like it to be the case that when we do this write, we don't have to wait to send a message on this shared bus. But that means we need to do something about, you know, the other values. So there's a strategy for this known as a cache coherency protocol. So there's going to be some agreed on way that processors communicate to coordinate how these values change. And that's going to be designed in a way where hopefully most of the time we don't need to tell every single CPU about our changes. And so basically there's going to have to be a way of reserving a value. And watching for other processors wanting to use it. So the, I should change the title of this slide. So, so the basic ideas are going to be that if you want to change a value that other processors might have, you use the bus to tell them, hey, get rid of your copy. You know. And if you want to start using a value another processor might have reserved by doing this prior operation, you have to first use the bus to say, hey, I'd like to use that value now. And, you know, each processor is going to track, you know, reserved values in some way. And by doing this, we can ensure that they can manipulate the value locally and not have to worry about communicating with the other processor all the time, only when they're initially acquiring sort of exclusive rights to a value. So a question, why do we have a cache on each CPU? Why not a global one? So we could indeed put a cache here on the memory, but there's one big issue is that this is going to be further away from the cores, so it's going to be slower than a cache on the CPU would be. Another issue is that we have better locality with the stuff each core accesses, so it's easier to make an efficient cache that only deals with one core stuff rather than a mixed workload from multiple cores. Okay. So in prior semesters, we've gone over sort of the details of this protocol. For time reasons, I'm not going to do that this semester. We're going a little bit slower because I take more time when we do online lectures, which hopefully is mostly time spent explaining things and not time fiddling around with technical stuff. So questions on this idea of how the processors need to coordinate. So for the most part, this coordination should be invisible, that the processor will automatically reserve a value when you start modifying it and handle this without you noticing. But it has some performance effects, and some of them are very noticeable. And there's one particular one I'd like to talk about, which is related to sort of the scope of this, that this cache coherency works on cache blocks. This is the, you know, units the cache stores. And to make caches efficient, cache block sizes are typically not that small. They're typically 64 bytes, maybe even 128 bytes. They're, you know, much bigger than a single value we'd read from memory, and that's because, well, there's a lot of bookkeeping to do with each thing that's stored in the cache, and also each time we retrieve something from that shared bus that takes a bunch of time, we want to make sure we're not getting just a little bit of stuff, we're getting enough to make it worth the time. So because of that, we have these bigger cache, big cache blocks, and that's the units that we're going to say, get rid of your copy. We're not going to say, get rid of your copy of this 4-byte int. We're going to say, get rid of your copy of this 64-byte value you might have in your cache. But this means that we have bad behavior when two processors are modifying different parts of a cache block, that we conceptually are doing things where we're editing independent things, but what's going to end up happening because of this cache coherency protocol is that the write instructions will happen one at a time, that when one processor writes to part of the cache block, it's going to have to reserve that block for itself. So it's going to have to send a message on the bus saying, hey, it's my turn to write to this 64-byte chunk of stuff. And then it's going to get the 64-byte chunk for itself and update its part of it. And then if the other processor also wants to write, it's going to have to do the same thing. And if they're both writing at the same time, this is going to cause a lot of contention and be very slow because we have this value kind of going back and forth between the two processors, even if they're actually writing to different parts of the cache block. So our cache block, you know, is this 64-byte thing, and maybe, you know, we have one variable here and one variable here that the two different cores are modifying, but that's not going to really change that the value has to ping-pong back and forth because all that will be seen in the, from the perspective of what needs to be cached is that we're caching this 64-byte value. So questions on this idea of the values ping-ponging. So we can, as I said, this has a performance effect, which we can observe. So here I have some code where I have a destination variable, and I sum up a large chunk of data accumulating my result in this destination variable. And I tried doing this from two different threads, where I have one thread write into element 0 of this array, and another thread write into element distance, where distance will be like 1 up to 1023 of this array. And I see, well, how fast does it run? So I just time doing this process, where we just sum up 64 million numbers, and we're doing it in parallel to two different places. And these are separate elements of this array, so they're independent of each other. There's not any question about what the result's going to be. There's no race condition here. But if they're in the same cache block, even though they're independent values from a programmer's perspective, from the processor's perspective, they're very dependent on each other and will have this bad performance when two threads are trying to modify at the same time, because they'll actually end up taking turns. And we can see this in performance numbers. So I changed that, which array element, so how many bytes into the array is what I've plotted down here. And my cache block size on the system I tested this on was 64 bytes. And when the two array elements were in the same cache block, this was a lot slower than when the two threads were writing to different cache blocks. So the reason I bring this up is that, well, this is a contrived example to kind of measure the problem, but you can do this by accident. That it's in fact very natural to have two threads writing to two adjacent elements of an array. In fact, that's one of the examples I may have shown for like passing values back from threads. But if they're writing frequently, it can be pretty bad for performance. And this problem is known as false sharing. So what's our solution to this? Well, the typical solution in practice is you want to get into this scenario. So even if it would waste some memory, you make sure the threads are writing to spaced out locations. So, questions about this idea? So this is known as false sharing. Questions about false sharing? Okay. So the question is, what causes the slowdown? So when, so we have this array here. So this is our array. And when our array is stored in caches, it's divided into these blocks, which on my system were 64 bytes. But each of these blocks holds multiple array elements. And our CPU, if we're writing to this array element, it needs to retrieve this whole cache block and reserve it for itself. So each core will reserve these 64 byte chunks, even if we're only writing part of that 64 byte chunk. Does that answer the question about reviewing what causes the slowdown? So, questions, why is the same block bad? So, to write to anything in this 64-byte chunk, a core needs to reserve for itself the entire chunk, which means if another core can't write at the same time. Okay, other questions about this? So now that we had this diversion into how two different cores or can share memory, let's talk a bit about, you know, actually implementing locks. And when I gave you the algorithm for implementing locks with atomic load and store, we said that we're not going to do that. That we're going to actually rely on special instructions. And what processors will generally provide is a what are called read, modify, write operations. And this is going to be, I should say, atomic read, modify, write operations. So we're going to have one instruction that atomically reads and modifies and writes a value in memory. And you might say, how is this going to work? Well, the way it's going to work is that that processor is going to reserve that value the way it reserves a cache block and do the read and the write all together with the value reserved. So we have a way of implementing this that's actually pretty simple if we're doing cache coherency anyways. And that's typically how they're implemented. And there's actually lots of flexibility as sort of what sort of operations we can provide. I'm only going to talk about one of these this semester, but if you look on a real processor, there's actually a huge variety of operations that they can provide, you know, as instructions that manipulate a value. So the one we're going to look at, the simple one, is on x86, there's an atomic exchange instruction. So it's listed in assembly, lock, exchange, and we can have two registers here. I have the 32-bit x86 version because this is what XV6 uses. So this instruction here, it reads from ECX into a temporary and writes EAX into memory at ECX and gives you the value that was previously in ECX. So it's an atomic swap. It takes the value in memory and the value in the register EAX and swaps them, but it's atomic. So it's going to do this without other processors changing ECX in the middle of it. That we're guaranteed that no processor can sneak in here and modify ECX in between that read and write. So this is an instruction that writes a value and reads an old value. So the question is, will compilers use this instruction? And the answer is generally going to be no. This is going to be something we're going to have to write by hand. And if you look at the XV6 code, they like write a little bit of assembly by hand, basically, to include this instruction. So this is an instruction that writes a fixed value and reads the old value. So the way we use it is that we're going to have our lock represented by a value. And when we want to do the locking operation, we're going to do a write of marking the lock as taken. And we're going to do a read to see if it was already taken. And our reasoning is that if it was already taken, well, we just set it to what it already was set to. So let's just move on and try again. And if it wasn't already taken, then we have acquired the lock. We're the exclusive owner of the lock. So I'll show you what that code looks like. This is the sort of, this is assembly that might do this on 64-bit x86, and this is very similar to how XV6's spin lock works. Here. So we have, say, a lock variable, which in this case is the lock. In a more flexible version of this, this would be come from an argument. And what we do is we take for acquiring the lock, we take the value 1 and we swap that in the lock and we see if the lock was 0 before. And if it wasn't, well, we didn't set it to 1. We just made it be 1 when it was already 1 and we try again. So we just keep doing this over and over and over again. Until eventually we set it from 0 to 1. And you might say, well, why would it be zero? Well, when someone releases the lock, they're going to set it to zero. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to have a fence here. So we're going to make sure that any loads and stores that were supposed to be protected by the lock finish before we actually let someone else acquire it. And then we're going to release the lock by marking it as free, which we're representing with a zero. We use one to represent that someone has the lock. So questions on this code here. So there's a question, why don't I need a memory fence for the acquire? So this has a side effect of a memory fence, side effect of mFence too. So a side effect of the lock exchange instruction is that it's also a memory fence. So question is, C code for locking requires assembly code. So it requires either assembly code or some special compiler support. So other questions? So this is commonly known as a spin lock. Why is it known as a spin lock? Well, because we wait in this loop, running this swap over and over and over again until we get the lock. We don't do something nice like give up the core to let something else run. We'll talk about how we do that a bit later. But this is sort of the simplest type of lock we can implement. Okay, so since we've seen this atomic instruction, let's apply this idea to a different thing we might want to implement. I'm sorry, I've cut off the options here on the slide, but you have them in the poll. That I want to implement the waiting functionality of pthread join. So I have this thread finish, which will be called when the thread finishes, and I want this wait for finish function to work. So how can I apply the same idea to make that happen? And I only need one wait for finish call to work. So something to note here is that our initial value for the finished variable is 0, and we're setting it to 1 here in whatever version of code you're choosing. So what we want to look for here is want to detect if finished is 1 yet. Which you might say, this is maybe not the only way we could have done this. So this is like maybe, you know, this is more complicated than it needs to be. Okay, so I think that's right. So a majority figured out what I think is the best answer of my choices, which is mFence, then a move into finish. So some of you wanted to put the mFence second. So I want it first. And the reasoning is I want to make sure before I set finished that everything I've done in the thread is going to be actually finished. If I do it the other way, it's possible that the finished variable's store will happen too early relative to other thing changes the thread makes. And this wait for finished function will return earlier than it should, in the sense that after the function, I might not be able to see some of the values that the thread changed. So then for this first part, as for what do I swap finished with, and it's unfortunate I'm swapping here. I'd really actually prefer to do a read to just do a move, to do a move finished into EAX. It's unfortunate I have to do a swap given the code that's set up here, but since I have to do a swap, I think I'd prefer to swap 0. So why would I want to swap 0? And the reason why is that I want it to be the case that if the thread hasn't finished, that I'm still going to be able to know when it finishes by seeing that there's a 1 in finished. If I swap 1, then the next time I go into this loop here, it will appear to me like, oh, it's 1. Did I set it or did the thread set it? So that's why I want to set it to 0. And as for what I do in this compare, if it's still 0, I want to try again. I heard a J either. So questions about how I got this answer here. Okay, so we've seen this idea of a spin lock here. So this lock that, you know, just waits in a loop. And this is, you know, something we can do. But it's kind of bad. And one way it's really obviously bad is that it wastes a lot of CPU time. It works, but it uses tons of CPU time running that loop when really we'd rather run something else. And if we're on a system with lots of threads, lots of processes, we have other stuff we could do a lot of the time. So our solution is that we're going to have a lock that's integrated with the scheduler, but we're going to build that lock using this spin lock idea. So we're going to take a spin lock like this and use it as part of how we're going to build a lock that works with the scheduler in that waiting case. And I'm going to call this type of lock a mutex. So POSIX mutexes are example of this type of lock, that when they need to wait, they don't just wait in an infinite loop until something changes. They have the scheduler run something else. So our lock operation, rather than running an infinite loop, is going to go to sleep and add itself to a list, and the unlock operation somehow going to tell the scheduler, hey, something went to sleep earlier because it was waiting for me to unlock. I've done that. Now start running it. And we're going to build this lock that integrates with the scheduler using spin locks. And why do we want spin locks? Well, we have a shared list, and we need to protect this with, you know, we're going to use a lock, a spin lock, to avoid race conditions in accessing the shared list. So our mutex is going to be built using a spin lock. And we want a spin lock because we have a shared data structure that's part of our mutex that we want to make sure we don't have any race conditions to worry about with. So we're going to have a shared spin lock that protects this shared list of waiters. And our lock operation is going to use the spin lock to modify that list of waiters, then release the spin lock and wait. Our unlock operation is going to use the spin lock to access the list of waiters and remove something from the list and tell the scheduler, hey, you can run this now. So how this might look. So here's our data structure for our mutex. So we have that internal spin lock that just protects these two things. So it's just used to access those two things, this lock taken variable and this actual list of waiting threads. And we'll have this lock taken variable, which we'll set to true whenever some thread has acquired and not released the lock, and false otherwise. And we'll have this wait queue, which will tell us that, hey, if there's a thread that's tried to do a lock and hasn't finished the lock yet, it's going to be on this queue. So here's what our code looks like for this. That our lock operation, we lock the spin lock. So that internal lock, we check if the lock is taken. And let's start with the simple case. Let's say the lock is not taken. We're the only one trying to access the shared resource the lock protects. Then we'll mark the lock as taken and unlock the internal spin lock. So we only hold this spin lock as long as we need to access these things. So that's the only reason we'll hold the spin lock, is because we're manipulating the lock taken or wait queue variable. If we're manipulating other things, we're not going to need the spin lock. And if the lock is already taken, we add ourselves to the queue of runnable threads and, you know, mark ourselves as not runnable and unlock the spin lock. So on the unlock side, we have our simple case is that we just set the lock as not taken and unlock the internal spin lock. But the complex case is, well, there's a thread waiting. So what we do in that case is we don't set lock the lock as not taken. We instead just hand off the lock to that thread by just marking it as runnable, telling the scheduler, hey, you can run this now, and removing it from the wait queue to remember that we marked it as runnable. So questions about how this works with the scheduler? So a question, why is there no lock taken equals false? Because in this case, when we unlock the lock and someone else is going to use the lock immediately afterwards, they are taking the lock on our behalf. So with this thread here, the remove thread, this other thread now has the lock, now has acquired the lock. And because this other thread has the lock, that thread has taken the lock and the lock is still taken. So the question is, why is a queue used? So I have told you that this is a queue. I have not said how it's sorted. And you might imagine that ideally we'd cooperate with the scheduler to figure out what order this queue is in. that answer that question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So one notable subtlety about this idea of implementing a mutex with the scheduler is that we need to be careful about marking threads as not runnable. That something we need to worry about is what if the unlock operation here occurs in between when we release the spin lock and when we run the scheduler. That in this case, you know, we have a sleeping thread that's still running. Here, because we've marked ourselves as not runnable, but we're still running, we need to make sure that this doesn't cause a problem. So the XV6 solution is lock the P table here. But there are other solutions you could imagine, but we need to do something to make sure that, you know, we are integrated with the scheduler in a way where we know we're not going to get confused. Because I've marked the thread as not runnable and haven't run the scheduler yet. So questions about that idea? So now, so we've seen, these are mutexes, so we've seen mutexes and people don't seem confused, at least for now. And something I like to note about how mutexes work in the normal case. So usually we're most concerned about how things work in the uncontended case, when there's not multiple threads interfering with each other. And in the normal case, note that the scheduler doesn't do anything. The uncontended case, if we only have one thread doing things at a time naturally, is that we lock a spin lock, set a Boolean, unlock it for locking, and we lock a spin lock, check a Boolean, set a Boolean, unlock it. So the uncontended case for mutexes is actually very, very fast. It's slower than a spin lock would be in the uncontended case because we're doing basically twice as much, a little more than twice as much work, but it's still actually very efficient. And so it doesn't really hurt us much to use locking and unlocking all the time if most of the time threads don't need to end up waiting. Okay. So we've seen basic pthread mutexes before. I just like to mention that pthread mutexes, we have this sort of attributes here. You might ask what sort of things can we put there. And one thing that's notable is that there are different types of mutexes POSIX supports, including error checking mutexes. So if you want to have better debugging support, you can have pthreads tell you if you make mistakes like unlocking a mutex that's already unlocked, which might be useful in a future assignment that uses mutexes. And related to this idea of ways you can use mutexes wrong is that it would seem from this implementation here that this unlock mutex, this doesn't care if you locked it. Like, it seems like this would work no matter what thread calls unlock, as long as there was a corresponding lock call somewhere. And that is true of the implementation I showed you. But pthread mutexes don't work this way. And if you want to know, like, why would that be the case? Well, POSIX wants to allow implementations that might do something like, instead of storing lock taken, they store the ID of the thread that has the lock. And so because of that, you must unlock a pthread mutex from the same thread you lock it in. Don't try to be clever and not do it. So that that's on mutexes. So I'm going to look at solving some problems with threads where we're going to need something more than locks. And I'm going to look at a very common pattern that happens with two threads. We're going to have a producer thread and a consumer thread. And the producer is going to produce values that's going to put into a buffer that's going to be shared between the producer and consumer thread. And the consumer thread is going to read things from this buffer. And we'd like it to be the case that if the producer gets ahead of the consumer, things start accumulating in this buffer. And if the consumer, you know, gets ahead of the producer, it waits for the producer to catch up. And if the buffer becomes full, the producer might, you know, stop for until the buffer has extra space. So we want to do this synchronization. And this pattern occurs all the time, which is why we're going to spend a lot of time talking about it, because a lot of problems that occur in real programs where you want to use multiple threads look like this. And to give you a simple example, a C compiler actually kind of looks like this. We have our preprocessor produces stuff for the compiler to use, which produces stuff for the assembler to use, which produces stuff for the linker to use. And if we want to have these running on different cores and communicating with each other, this is the kind of pattern we want. That we want to have the preprocessor output accumulated somewhere so the preprocessor can get ahead of the compiler a little bit. And we want to, you know, do the similar between the compiler and assembler and so. So we're going to need abstractions that handle this case. And locks aren't going to be sufficient because of this. We need to have this waiting operation. And there's not actually a very good way of doing that with mutexes. It just doesn't let us do that waiting operation. So we're going to look at an abstraction that extends locks that does this. And the first one I'm going to look at is something called monitors and or condition variables. So a monitor is going to be sort of this abstraction, which is composed of one or more locks, generally one lock, we'll say, and what we'll call condition variables. Now, condition variables is a horrible name, but unfortunately, it's what everyone uses. So a condition variable doesn't hold a value. A condition variable represents a list of things waiting for something. So this is, a condition variable is a list of waiters, of waiting threads, is how you should look at it. It doesn't actually hold a value. It doesn't hold a condition. It's just a list of waiting threads. So this is going to provide two operations, a wait operation to add yourself to the list of waiting threads, and a signal or broadcast operation, we'll talk about the difference later, to take a waiting thread and let it run. And so these are our synchronization parts of a monitor, and we're going to say that the monitor also includes the things that are protected by the lock, the things that we only access using the lock that are related to the things that the threads are waiting for. So in object-oriented languages, monitors are commonly represented as objects. And in fact, in Java, every object is already a monitor. Every object has a built-in lock and a built-in condition variable. If you've used the synchronize keyword in Java, that's the built-in lock. If you've used the .wait method in object, that's the built-in condition variable. In pthreads, things are not so object-oriented. It's based on C, so you build your own. So pthreads provides you with locks and condition variables independently, and that's the API I'll be focusing on. So here's our monitors. So we have our lock, and we're going to have a rule that we require the lock before doing anything with anything that's part of the monitor. And that's going to be done by each operation our monitor supports. The lock has a list of threads that are waiting for it. We saw that in that mutex implementation. And we also have condition variables, which are threads which aren't waiting for the lock, but are waiting for something about this shared data to become true. So if we think of our producer-consumer example, we might be waiting for it to be true that there's something in the buffer, and the shared data is our buffer. And these condition variables that represent these list of waiting threads, they have operations, which are going to be sort of key to how we actually take advantage of these monitors. So we have a wait operation, which takes a condition variable and a lock, and it adds the current thread to the list of threads waiting that the condition variable holds, and unlocks the lock while we're waiting, and it relocks the lock when we're done waiting. So the idea is that we acquire the lock, we figure out, now that I've acquired the lock, I can access the buffer without worrying about race conditions. Does the buffer have something for me? Oh, the answer is no. I'm going to wait, releasing the lock while I'm waiting, but I'll acquire it back when I'm done waiting because I want to access the buffer without race conditions. We also have a broadcast and signal operation, which remove things from the condition variable through queues, making them runnable. So they're no longer waiting after we broadcast or signal them and come runnable. So wait adds us to this waiting queue. Waiting queue and removes us from the and unlocks the lock. Broadcast removes everyone from a particular condition variable's waiting queue. And because they probably waited with the lock, basically the first thing they're going to do is wait to acquire the lock. So we can think of it as taking them from waiting for a condition to become true to waiting for the lock to do their thing with the shared data. And signal chooses one thread via an unspecified way to stop waiting and acquire the lock. So questions about condition variable operations? Okay, so to give it a simple example of usage, here is that same idea of waiting for something to become finished. So I have a variable finish. This is my shared data. And I have a lock and a condition variable. So my finished function, it sets the finished variable to true. That's our shared data. And it broadcasts on the condition variable to say, hey, if anyone was waiting for something for this finish to be true, because they called con wait to say they are, then it wakes them up, lets them start running again, and we unlock that after we're done. So we have this pattern. We acquire the lock before we access finished. And when we're waiting, we first check whether we're finished. And you might say, why are we using a loop and not an if statement? It turns out we need a loop. We'll talk about why later. And while that finished is not true, we're going to add ourselves to the list of waiters, that things that are waiting for it to become true. And what we're waiting for is we're waiting for the thread that calls finish to call broadcast. And, you know, that's going to be what releases us. And so there's sort of two ways that this could end up executing. So one way is that we call wait for finished before the finished thread finishes, before someone calls finished, in which case we'll call the wait function and then get woken up and exit the wait for finished function. The other way is that we can call wait for finished afterwards. And that's why I checked this finished condition before I waited, because it might be the case that wait for finished didn't actually run until after finish. And I mentioned, you say, why is there this loop here? And the short answer is because pthreads is not nice. We'll talk more about like why it might have chosen this, but basically pthreads says, this pthread con wait, your thread will be woken up and removed from the list of waiting threads either when someone calls broadcast or signal or just randomly. So that's why we have this while loop. We'll talk about why they chose to do that next time. Okay. So this is where I'll finish up. I'll take questions before I sign off. So the question is, why don't we have to call unlock before broadcast? So one reason why is because the broadcast operation just makes the threads runnable and basically makes them start waiting for the lock. So it doesn't actually need to run the threads right away. It just marks them as something we'll run in the future. Does that answer that question?